This is Corporate Watchdog Radio, bringing you news, interviews, and commentary on corporate sustainability. I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The sustainability of the war economy?
It sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? A sustainable military.
That's Hunter Lovins of Natural Capital Solutions.
The F-22 fighter has a piece of it made in 45 U.S. states. Now, I only took Econ 101, but something tells me that that's not an efficient way to build an aircraft. But it is a smart way to build an aircraft if what you're looking to do is to build it in such a way that nobody can shut down the flow of money to your system.
And that's Eugene Jarecki. His book is The American Way of War.
The Inspector General Stuart Bowen for Reconstruction has now issued a 513-page study in which he details the mind-boggling amount of waste in the Reconstruction program.
And that's Harvard professor Linda Bilmes, co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of The Trillion Dollar War. Francesca, this show has its roots in a heated debate we had returning from the Investor Summit on Climate Risk at the United Nations in February.
Yeah, Bill, I was grousing to you that war was nowhere on the agenda. That felt like a huge omission because we're spending our treasure on war when we need to be investing in climate solutions. And war itself is the antithesis of sustainability.
And I argued that war does intersect with investment, but it's primarily a political issue. So institutional investors have less leverage on it than they do on climate issues. But in the end, I realized you were right, that war and investing are intimately linked, and any discussion of sustainability must address the role played by war.
Well, Bill, it was very gratifying to have you admit that I was right. And today we invite our listeners into the conversation as we talk with three experts on the issue. First, with a Corporate Watchdog Radio news analysis, we talk with Hunter Lovins about the Army's efforts to become more sustainable.
Hunter Lovins co-founded the Rocky Mountain Institute with Amory Lovins in 1982, and she co-authored the book Natural Capitalism with Amory Lovins and Paul Hawken. She went on to found Natural Capitalism Solutions, which helps businesses, governments, and organizations develop strategies for sustainability. Among her consultees is the U.S. Army.
In September, the Army came out with its own sustainability report called Sustain the Mission, Secure the Future. We asked Hunter Lovins what sustainability means when applied to the military.
It sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? A sustainable military. Actually, mostly what the military does, particularly when they're not overseas warfighting, is run large bases, which are essentially small cities. They house people, feed people, move people around, all of which has historically been done very inefficiently. That takes money, which from the military point of view takes money away from warfighting. And the way in which all of our national infrastructure is designed is very vulnerable. The military is conscious of this, so they have been working with a number of groups, including my group, Natural Capitalism Solutions, to make, for example, the Fort Carson military base as energy efficient as it can be, as water efficient as it can be, to run off renewable energy, and to be much more resilient in event of any sort of an attack, which will enable it to do its job, as it sees it, of protecting the American people from attack or the ability to project American force overseas as asked by the commander-in-chief.
You alluded to the fact that the idea of the military and sustainability sounds like an oxymoron. So I want to actually push that point a little bit, and it may be a bit of an unfair question. But the business of the military is to go to war. Can we really say, for example, with the use of depleted uranium, the carbon footprint of bombing, the social part of sustainability is also social sustainability, the social fallout of war, the blowback, if we may call it. Can we really say that war is environmentally and socially sustainable?
Of course not. The way in which we have attempted to enhance the security of American people has done anything but. It's quite to the contrary. We are decreasing our security everywhere around the world. I've done a lot of work in Afghanistan, and when I first started going there, shortly after the Americans kicked out the Taliban, Afghans would come up to me on the street. Being blonde, I'm fairly obviously not an Afghan, and they would ask if I were an American. Amri Kawi, I would say Bali, yes. And they would say, Tashakor, thank you. They were deeply grateful. There was an enormous reservoir of goodwill. That's gone, largely, because of the way in which we have allowed contractors to run rampant, killed civilians, and not attended to the genuine development needs of the Afghan people. If we want genuine security in Afghanistan, we'll do the same thing there that we need to do in our own country of transforming the economy using world best practice in sustainable ways to meet basic human needs, delivering energy, water, housing, health care, sanitation, transportation, by empowering the Afghans to meet their own needs in least cost ways. This is the only hope we're going to have of being able to pull our troops out, and it will win us the best friends we've ever had. This is true the world around. We project military force because we want to, for example, in Iraq, protect access to what we like to think of as our oil. Let's get off the need for oil at all, and then we won't have to go adventuring in that way.
To hear the complete interview with Hunter Lovins, including specific examples of military sustainability and more in-depth analysis, check out corporatewatchdogradio.org.
In our extended interview, we asked Hunter Lovins about the Army's definition of the triple bottom line in its sustainability report that was mission, environment, and community. The Army says its primary mission is to defend the United States. But our next guest, Eugene Jarecki, thinks there may be a more mercenary purpose, to enrich military contractors. Jarecki directed the film Why We Fight. Then he wrote a book arising out of the film, The American Way of War. Your book begins with President Dwight David Eisenhower's 1961 farewell address, the famous one, in which he warns Americans to guard against the military-industrial complex. Now, I've heard that he wanted to add congressional to the military-industrial. Is that true?
Yes, in the original drafts of the farewell address, Eisenhower's formulation had indeed been military-industrial congressional complex, because he was keenly aware of the role that, of course, Congress inevitably plays in sort of making possible this corruption of our system.
Corruption of our system. I mean, the congressional is a key part of that, and a major point of your book is how this system has corrupted our democracy.
Yes.
Can you lay out just maybe some of the broad outlines of that first before we dive more into the meat of the book?
Sure. I mean, there's no question that when I started out, what I got from Eisenhower as inspiration was his comments about the military-industrial complex. But the deeper I looked and the more I learned things like his focus on Congress and his focus on other forms of corruption and just the broad sort of sweeping view he had of the dangers of what he called the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded, that what he was focusing on was really something much larger, a kind of corporate political complex that has come to imperil our capacity as a society to live up to our Republican ideals.
Now, as I understand this, the origins, I mean, industrial capitalism has been around in this country since perhaps the 1830s,
yes.
But that this military industrial capitalism really got going during World War II, or perhaps even before in the build-up to that.
It did, but I want to point out that it's almost unfair to single out the military-industrial sector as if it's the root of all evil in Washington. The fact is, this is far larger. This is simply about corporate power and the fact that corporate power makes Congress people professional pleaders on behalf of the corporations that are their benefactors in their districts. And who they plead to is ultimately the executive. And since you know that the executive favors war, that makes the Congress people vulnerable to the war-making wishes of the executive. So to give you a silly example for this, you know, it's one thing when we talk about defense expenditure, and we say, isn't it ridiculous that we spend such and such on a toilet seat or such and such on a hammer? But let's take a more interesting example, the F-22 fighter. The F-22 fighter has a piece of it made in 45 U.S. states. Now, I only took Econ 101, but something tells me that that's not an efficient way to build an aircraft. But it is a smart way to build an aircraft if what you're looking to do is to build it in such a way that nobody can shut down the flow of money to your system. Because by putting it in so many states and a majority of congressional districts, what you're doing is making it so that when somebody questions the F-22 and says, is this a worthy program, everybody in Congress is getting a piece of the action. And so they fall awfully quiet when those questions arise. Now, this is bad enough because it leads to bad expenditure. I mean, think about it. The F-22 is an air-to-air combat aircraft. We don't have an enemy with an air force, and we've spent $70 billion on it at a time of enormous financial collapse. So when you start to see these inane decisions and you wonder, well, it's bad enough that we're wasting the money, the next question is, well, does it lead to war? And I argue that whether it's an F-22 being made in your district or whether it's an aspirin maker in your district or a media company in your district, the fact that the congressperson has to plead on their behalf, which is a flaw in our system that was unanticipated and must be fixed, the fact that they have to do that is what makes them vulnerable, ultimately, to the slippery slope toward war that comes with executive power. So in many ways, you have to have an understanding of this that's more comprehensive, that includes basically a dynamical understanding of how corporate power compromises the purity of congressional decision-making, and by doing so, makes congressional figures quiet when crucial votes come, puts them in a conflict of interest. Give you an example. Let's say on a Monday, you're a congressperson, and that F-22 is made in your district. So you call the executive branch. And the reason you're calling the executive branch on a Monday is because you want to lobby the executive branch for continued support for the F-22 program because the maker is in your district. Well, the reason you have to call the executive branch is that that's where the Department of Defense is. So you call the DOD and you say, you know, the good people of my district work very hard on the F-22. We know there are people who question its legitimacy in a post-Cold War world, but, you know, you never know what the future might bring, and the good people in my district really care about this as a part of America's arsenal. We hope you'll take that under advisement, Mr. Rumsfeld, when the next vote comes up. And so the DOD says to you, thank you a lot for your call. We, too, share an interest in the F-22. We don't want to see it go either, but, of course, we got to look at a lot of systems. But we sure do value you and your constituents for the hard work they're doing. Thanks for the call. That's on a Monday. On Tuesday, the phone rings, and it's another member of the executive branch. This time, it's the president. And he says to you, Congressman, I think there might be WMDs in Iraq, and if I feel the need to take action, I'm hoping I can count on your support. Well, just yesterday, you were the one asking for a favor. So how strongly are you going to do your Jeffersonian duty and say, Mr. President, you show me the evidence of those WMDs?
Well, that is a powerful example there. Especially under this administration, this last 8 years, we've seen tremendous increase in the privatization of the defense industry, of the conducting of war. How does that change things?
This is the same American affliction deep down in our soul that's manifesting itself in all kinds of symptoms around the body politic. So you have an affliction, which is that this system is corrupt and broken in the inside. And that's why the levies weren't up to scratch. That's why the economy is crashing. That's why we have a population that's insufficiently educated to compete in the global space. That's why we have uninsured people. We have so many areas that you could look at and say, ah, there's a symptom. And usually what it comes down to is that part of our national affliction is a Kool-Aid that everybody drank with Ronald Reagan, that where we started to believe that the public good can be left to the private sector to take care of. That's trickle-down. And trickle-down is nonsense, and we've just seen it play out in the crash of the marketplace. Reagan should by now have his stock price begin to finally lower, because that stuff, that idea that if the rich people just make themselves richer and richer, somehow it'll benefit the rest of us, that is not playing out. And so what that tells me is that when you look at the privatization of military functions, it's just the same old idea again. Leave it to the powerful, and the rest of us will be taken care of. Well, try telling that to the soldiers who didn't get body armor in Iraq while our private contractor counterparts were covered in body armor and well taken care of, fed, and paid. And so that privatization of military functions has a legion of disastrous implications and consequences. But the first and most glaring one is that gulf that you see between the sort of quality of care and quality of approach taken with the private, that of course never trickles down to the public, sergeant or private or major in the field who's dealing with real life and death situations and is underprepared compared to his private counterparts.
We're talking with Eugene Jarecki about his first film and now book, The American Way of War. Many people say the war industry stimulates the economy, and they point to World War II, saying it was the war that got us out of the Depression. What's your take on the role of the defense economy in stimulating the larger economy?
I think it's just the defense business justifying itself. I think the mafia would tell you that violence does them good, too. That doesn't mean it's moral or that it has a sustainable long-term vision. So this country, if it operates on a Keynesian idea of militarism as a engine for economic growth, will find that Eisenhower is right and they are wrong. That Eisenhower said you cannot let a society be misguided in its national priorities toward an excess of militarism. George Washington said it too, that ultimately the cost of that, Eisenhower is a wonderful phrase, you know, what he depicts is a society that can run away with itself in its own hysteria. Eisenhower was very clear in his time, both as a general and then president, that, as he said, you can never have perfect security. No nation can have it any more than the rest of us know that we could walk out our front door and get hit by a car. And we don't hyper-securitize our lives. We don't, therefore, not leave the house. We don't walk around with body armor in case of that. We just take that risk. We understand it's an imperfect world. Well, governments, because it serves them and it serves the powerful, very often get the people worked into a lather in the pursuit of perfect security, into a paranoid, hysteric frenzy. And since you can never have perfect security, along the way what you can do is bankrupt yourself trying to achieve it, which is what we're watching right now. And so I only raise this because the idea that we should lean on militarization as an engine for social growth, and there's no question that, sure, if you have any industry that you pour a great deal of public resources into, whether it's building bridges or building bombs, it's going to have a productive outcome. And Barack Obama, for example, has suggested that he wants to do this with a kind of green revolution. You can point to anything. It's just the defense sector has been ruling the roost for the last half century, and so they've been able to say, hey, look at the kind of growth we've produced. And I would say that's because that's where we put our money.
Well, talking about the green revolution as opposed to a war economy,
sure.
I heard Barney Frank, Congressman Barney Frank, answering a reporter's question on how are we going to pay for the bailouts, pay for a green economy. He answered it by pointing to the costs of war. And he said, few question the necessity for those costs. Now, do you think he's just playing to the base, or do you think that there is any spine for cutting military costs?
Oh, goodness. I mean, Barney Frank recently called for a 25% cut in defense spending, which, as military analysts will tell you, can actually be undertaken without reducing America's effective defense at all, not 1%. So there is a tremendous amount of profligacy and downright corrupt nonsense going on in the defense sphere. And if you look at what we spend on defense, which is more than the rest of the world combined and more than all other parts of our discretionary federal budget combined, surely you would do the society a great deal of good to simply, you know, tighten up the corruption that exists in that sphere. But I have to say, I think something more systemic and deep-seated is going on. I'm not comfortable with these bailouts, and I'm largely not comfortable because I'm not a Democrat or a Republican who is sitting in Congress on the payroll of a system that has a fundamentally corrupt vision of national priorities and national governance. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, there is something about these bailouts that smacks to all of us like a double standard. Like one day, you're a poor person in America, and you're a working person, or you're a mom and pop who own a little grocery or a shoe store, and you're told for years and years that the reason you're not further along and higher up the food chain is that it's a survival of the fittest, and the big boys are just fitter than you are, but good luck. You're also told, if you're poor, for example, that the little bit of a social safety net you're getting in your welfare check or your unemployment or your whatever little help you're getting, if there is much for you, is a gigantic drain on the system. And now here we are this many years later, and it turns out when the rich and powerful collapse, when their car wash goes belly up or their shoe store goes belly up, there's a golden safety net for them. And on top of the golden safety net, it seems as though Darwin suddenly goes out the window and we no longer think about it as survival of the fittest. So there is something really pernicious at work. And when you see both parties lining up in their own way to sort of score points on this, it's the business as usual of being in Washington. And you'll notice, well, this week it's the guys who have a benefit from the auto industry. Last week it was the guys who are tied into Wall Street.
Now, I'd like to ask you a question that often is not asked, and that is about the environmental costs of war in economic terms. How do they translate into a drag on the economy?
Sure. I mean, you know, you have to think about it this way. Eisenhower's vision of the military-industrial complex is a vision of a person who was both a military conservative and a fiscal conservative. And he understood that those go hand in glove, because basically part of the reason the framers were afraid of foreign entanglements was not only that they can make the executive too powerful, because every time there's a problem anywhere in the world, he suddenly starts saying, hey, there's no habeas corpus, there's no more constitution, leave everything up to me. They didn't want that. But they also were afraid of the other ravages that war brings to our liberties, but also to the health of our society. And it's Eisenhower who puts the finest point on this when in 1953, 8 years before he gave his farewell address, he makes a speech called the Chance for Peace speech, where he says, effectively, he shows the comparison between what we spend on given weapons systems and what that costs us in the health of our republic in other ways. So he says, the cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in over 30 cities. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is this many bushels of wheat. It's incredibly poignant, the speech. And by doing that comparison, he shows the sort of standoff between guns and butter. Well, the environment is our modern butter. It's one of those issues that when you are putting your money disproportionately toward defense, you are not putting it toward a more indirect, but no less important, fundamental need at a national level. So what Eisenhower teaches us at the end of the day is that you have to have a comprehensive vision of national security, that a nation's strength is her security, and a nation's strength is about more than just bombs. You have to have a nation that is surviving the environment to even be alive to fight. You have to have an educated population, because if a population is uneducated, they're unfit for war. If a population is unhealthy, they're unfit for war. If a population has failing infrastructure, not only are they drowning in the streets, but our rivals in the world see that as the weakness that invites more aggression. What Eisenhower is ultimately saying is that the best answer to 9/11 would not have been some hysterical and ultimately rather embarrassing show of force, but the best idea would have been to have some measure of military action combined with other decisions, like after 9/11 we could have fortified our healthcare system, we could have fortified our education system, we could have fortified our environmental approaches. We could have made ourselves a place of tomorrow where it would become that much harder to recruit against us. There are so many ways in which a nation's strength is defined. And all too often, because it's convenient to those who benefit from it, we are only fed by the powerful the most simplistic expression of national power, which is using weapons.
It's still early after the election.
Sure.
So we still, you know, Barack Obama is not yet the president.
Right.
What are the winds that you're feeling blowing in terms of the issues that you bring to the fore with your book?
Well, the issues in my book reveal to anyone who reads it, I hope, how unbelievably deep-seated the corruption in Washington is and how it does not belong to one party or another. The Republicans aren't more corrupt or more war-making than the Democrats. The last century brought us as many wars run by Democrats as Republicans, and I will remind us all that under this sort of adage that bad things happen when good people do nothing, if somebody has a lot of belief in the Democrats, you have to ask yourself why these people let this entire calamity happen in the last 8 years. Where was the outrage, indeed? So now I'm looking at a situation where we have Barack Obama in. There's a whole new moment that feels like it might be afoot. But be very careful. Do not be fooled. The forces in Washington don't care that Barack Obama is a very decent person and a deep person and a thoughtful person. All the things you can feel from watching him not take cheap shots as a candidate, for example. It doesn't care. It will chew him up and spit him out so quickly that our heads will spin if we, the public, are not doggedly and unrelentingly exerting our pressure as a force demanding change from below. No change in human history has ever been trickled down, any more than any economy has ever been trickled down.
Hear, hear. Well, Eugene Jarecki, thanks so much for talking with us here on Corporate Watchdog Radio.
Thank you very much.
Eugene Jarecki is the director and producer of the film Why We Fight, and the book he wrote from that film, The American Way of War.
Finally, for the Corporate Watchdog Radio Viewpoint, we speak with Linda Bilmes, co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of The $1 Trillion War. She blogged this week about the report issued by the Office of the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. It showed millions of taxpayer dollars have been wasted on the reconstruction effort. Ironically, the government created problems by delaying spending to begin with.
The money was enacted. It became available October 1st, 2003. And then it sat there for a year due, unbelievably enough, to a turf battle between essentially Secretary Rumsfeld and the committee chairman in Congress Congress had asked for this money to be competitively awarded. Rumsfeld was supposed to send a letter to the committee chairman if he decided that he wanted it to be sole source awarded, which he did, but he refused to send the letter. And so, tied up in this enormous bureaucratic snafu, as well as the fact that the Pentagon tends to move slowly in its procurement, you found that by the next summer, virtually none of this money had been spent. And it was during this period of time, if you recall, in 2003, that things completely deteriorated in Iraq. You know, the water didn't get turned back on, the electricity didn't get back on. You know, the country's security situation deteriorated very, very much, and we kind of lost the hearts and minds of many people in Iraq who saw that, you know, the amount of damage that was being created. And by the following summer, when some of the money finally became available to be used, by this time the security situation had unraveled to such an extent that the cost of doing anything, you know, the cost of painting a police station or repairing a utility had gone up by three or four times because all the money was going to security costs. Just to put it in context, and we're talking about spending three times per Iraqi on reconstruction what we spent per European in the Marshall Plan. So this is a massive effort which essentially failed.
What were some of the things that the Marshall Plan did right as opposed to this?
One of the things that the Marshall Plan did was it employed local people. And here we essentially relied on subcontractors and contractors, most of them imported from Malaysia and the Philippines and Sri Lanka and, you know, so forth. And I will give you an example. We actually import sand and sandbags into Iraq, even though Iraq has quite a lot of sand. So all the sandbags used by our military, which is a staple of military life, is imported from Kuwait. Now, why is this? This is because during the worst days of the war, when our vehicles were not up-armored, our troops were essentially improvising by sandbagging their vehicles for safety. And because they traveled from Kuwait into Iraq, Kuwait developed a kind of thriving cottage industry in sandbag stuffing. Now, if you look at where the actual bags come from, the bags were awarded on a no-bid contract to a contractor in Texas who manufactured them in Puerto Rico, shipped them to Kuwait. In Kuwait, you had Kuwaiti subcontractors from Malaysia, the Philippines, and so forth, actually stuffing these bags with sand, tying them up, then loading them onto trucks where they were shipped at world oil prices into Iraq. Now, you sort of think that through. First of all, it's obvious that it's an extremely expensive way to get sand into Iraq. And second of all, the number of levels there in which there are opportunities for profiteering and skimming off contracts are multiple. And you have this kind of thing happening in every aspect of the war, and particularly around the Reconstruction money.
It really boggles the mind.
It does, because it would be hard to think up a less efficient or more expensive way to do this if you tried. And I think that the Inspector General Stuart Bowen for Reconstruction has now issued a 513-page study in which he details the mind-boggling amount of waste in the Reconstruction program. And I think that the single most damning point that he makes in this study is that in the end, probably $100 billion has been spent on rebuilding, reconstructing things in Iraq, and that everything that has been reconstructed and rebuilt, everything, are things that were destroyed during the invasion or the subsequent looting. So all we've done is rebuilt what we destroyed.
That was Linda Bilmes, co-author of The Trillion Dollar War. For the complete interview, check out corporatewatchdogradio.org.
Thanks for listening to Corporate Watchdog Radio. Check us out on the web at www.corporatewatchdogradio.org.
There you can subscribe to our podcast and listserv. Thanks for listening.
I'm Bill Bowie.
And I'm Francesca Rhiannon.